Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to the great story of these Christian brave hearts. One of the inspirations for this study that I did a few years back was this series by the name I mentioned a day or two ago, Douglas Bond, Duncan's War. It's a Crown and Covenant three-part series, and I had a great time reading with Ev and Ty, and we've been reading another one of Douglas Bond's books as a family lately, and including Zeke, and look forward to going through these with Zeke as well. Steve Lawson also has a great biography on John Knox, a brief little summary here of what it means to have a fearless faith. Also highly recommend these to you. There's a few things more exciting than church history and how it fires our faith and sets before us these manly examples of Christian courage and heroic obedience to the Lord. Here's where we've been last time, if you recall, Scottish church history, and these Christian bravehearts we're learning from, the Covenanters. King James had died, Charles I had replaced him, hated the Scottish Christians, these Covenanter Presbyterians. There's a picture there of that lady Jenny Geddes throwing her stool in righteous anger against the blasphemer and the false teacher in the pulpit that had come over from the Anglican church and was enforcing unbiblical things on their church. And William Laud was unloosed, as we mentioned last time. And then, as you know, we talked about the two major covenants that defined these covenanters, who were people of their word, who gave their pledge and their yes was yes. And they wanted to nail their colors to the mast and put a stake in the ground of their biblical conviction, how crucial this is in a wishy-washy, very effeminate age where nobody knows what they believe anymore. And everything's just a suggestion or an opinion or second-guessing or hesitating. It's a virtue to look and sound humble and not certain of anything. But the Bible warns that the trumpet should give no uncertain sound. And these are great examples of that. And so remember, they signed that national covenant, and then they signed that solemn league and covenant. Then Charles II takes the throne. He acts like he's a friend of these covenanters, the Scottish Presbyterians. But then we're going to learn today about this 28-year furnace persecution, as I sit here by the fireplace, for the covenanters. Now, picking up that story, it was S.M. Houghton, the historian, who describes these events of the Civil War and Commonwealth periods for England. We're not going to discuss, but Scotland and England basically started falling apart now in the 1640s and 50s, not without war, only to be brought together again politically by the union of the parliaments, which England enforced after its military triumph. But England as a nation soon got tired of this Puritan domination. And in 1660, the son of Charles then returns to rule England and Scotland as Charles II. Remember, this was all with assumption of this national church, that you didn't have to be converted, you just had to be born into it. A citizen of the political kingdom made you a member of the church. It was compulsory, not voluntary. Very deadly, again, a Roman Catholic hangover and an unbiblical concept that caused so much damage. So almost immediately, Charles II takes the throne and he martyrs the man who enthroned him as king, the Marquis or Marquis, as they pronounce it, of Argyll, the first martyr of the covenanting cause, whose dying words were, "I set the crown on the king's head. He hastens me to a better crown." What a courage. What an eternal heavenly focus. A major reason, if not the reason, Charles II opposed the Covenanters was because they weren't afraid to practice church discipline. Even kings and princes and nobility. Hey, you may be the head of this realm, but you can be put out of the church because Christ is above Caesar. And Jesus is Lord, not you, King Charles. And like John the Baptist with King Herod, these covenanter preachers and elders in their churches had no price. They were not for sale. Their convictions were not negotiable. And the king was angered by this because he knew he couldn't buy them. And so we enter into now the covenanter period from the 1660s onwards in this lengthy furnace of almost 30 years of fierce persecution in the heart of their heroism in the faith. By the way, Ruth Bell Graham, Billy Graham's wife, says her favorite Christian book next to the Bible is this book by Alexander Smellie that I mentioned, The Men of the Covenant. In these 28 years, over 18,000 believers were either killed or banished from their homeland, men and women, many of them young people. 1,700 were shipped to plantations, many dying in the journey. 750 were banished in the Northern Islands or murdered on the way. Almost 4,000 imprisoned, confined, tortured. 680 died in battle. 7,000 fled to other countries for exile. At least nearly 500 were murdered in cold blood. 362 were executed, mostly by hanging on the scaffold. And usually in Edinburgh, and after they were hung, their bodies were dressed on a table in the historic Magdalene Chapel. Michelle and I have been to that chapel. We have seen that table. Then often, in a gruesome fashion, that only the head and the hands of the martyrs would be displayed in prominent places as a warning to the rest. Many other hundreds, in fact, a few thousand more perished through cold and hunger and other distresses, fleeing from their persecutors into the hills and the moors and the Brae of Scotland. Through all this, the motto for which they lived and died was, "For Christ's crown and his covenant." Why? Why this motto? Well, it came down to their ecclesiology, something that's intensely important for us today. If you look at our Antioch Declaration of Faith, it's the longest of all our 13 or so sections of doctrine, the doctrine of the church. They were jealous for Christ's headship over his church, the lordship of Jesus, and no one else. They would tolerate no rivals, no other rulers governing Christ's church, but Jesus alone. They had not forgotten the centuries Scotland spent in darkness under the reign of the Pope, where man-made traditions and rituals and superstition ruled the church instead of Christ's word, the sacred scriptures, the Bible. But thanks to the Protestant reformers and brave men of the faith like Wycliffe and Tyndale and Luther and Calvin and John Knox, God's word had been rescued from the dungeons and restored to its rightful place at the helm of the ship, at the center of the church. The pulpit is Christ's throne through which he rules his church, as the Bible is taught and preached. From their allegiance to God's word, the Covenanters were unshakably convinced of passages like Ephesians 1, verse 22. God placed all things under Christ's feet and appointed him to be head over everything for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. They were ready to die for the truth of Colossians 1, verse 18. Christ is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn among the dead, so that everything he might have the supremacy. The Covenanters would not let go of Colossians 2, verse 19, that Christ is our head, from whom the whole body, supported and held together by its ligaments and sinews, grows as God causes it to grow. You see, beloved, based on texts like this, the Covenanters knew that the church was no mere province of some earthly king, no matter how powerful or even seemingly religious that king might be. The Covenanters knew the church was part of another kingdom, not of this world, with a king of our own, not some absentee monarch or figurehead. No, a living, active, present, real, ruling head and shepherd and master and Lord of his church, King Jesus, and we are his glad subjects. And his word alone must govern us. And we are truly free as his church, only when no other outside authority interferes with his rule over us and our freedom to obey his word alone. See, this Covenanter zeal for freedom of worship, beloved, it's kind of hard for us to grasp today, having enjoyed religious liberty for so long. But who knows, as we see the world changing before our very eyes, religious freedom increasingly threatened, our Christian brothers and sisters in places like China and Iran and Middle East and Northern Africa and Indonesia and Myanmar and so forth, dying under the same banner as the Covenanters, for Christ's crown and his covenant. Perhaps also, friends, we underestimate all the ways that Christ's crown and lordship is already being undermined in our churches and threatened more than we realize. Maybe not outward as much through political pressure, though that seems to be increasing, but especially in areas where, and even recent rulings here in South Africa requiring ministers to perform gay and lesbian marriages and so forth. But think also of the subtle and perhaps even more dangerous ways that we are tempted to usurp Christ's crown rights in our church, perhaps through pragmatism and consumerism, individualism, and private spirituality that undermines the corporate gathering of the church. Postmodernism and sentimentalism, psychology, selfish narcissism, and so forth. All these things Paul warned the Colossians about. Remember Colossians 2 verse 8, don't be taken captive to these worldly philosophies which are not built on Christ as our head. And so as we see the zeal of our Scottish Christian forefathers for Christ's crown and his covenant, their example ought to set our hearts ablaze with a greater jealousy to see King Jesus and his word as our final and all-sufficient authority. See you tomorrow.